the B-I-B-L-E. Yes, that's the book for me. I stand alone on the word of God, the B-I-B-L-E.
The B-I-B-L-E. Yes, that's the book for me. I stand alone on the word.
Hey, Bob. What are you doing?
Nothing. Just cleaning up a little.
Well, good morning. Whether you are here in person or listening to our podcast or checking us out online, man, we just want you to know how incredibly excited we are that you have chosen to join us on this Memorial Day weekend as we officially land the plane in this series we have been calling The Bible for Grownups. And if you're here for the very first time, or maybe just here for the first time during this particular series, man, we want you to know that we believe you are here on the perfect weekend. Because this weekend, we do something that we have been unable to do for every week of this series leading up until this point. This is the official weekend in which we put the last piece of the puzzle in place. This is the weekend in which we have an opportunity to officially tie a bow on this series. Because if you've been here for any of this series up until this point, what you know is this, is that every week we have left here and every question has not been answered. Is that there has still been tension unresolved. And yet today, with every puzzle piece in place, we have an opportunity to officially get the complete picture of why in our lives, right here, right now, today, this book is believable and true and relevant in 2021. And maybe today, even though you've missed some of this series, that today will be a day in which we whet your appetite enough that you go back and you listen to the rest of this series. You see, the reason we're doing a series like this is simply because we're a church that's willing to acknowledge this reality. That for so many of us, we either grew up in church or we grew up reading stories in the Bible, and yet at some point, we began to walk away. We began to drift in our faith, and we began to drift on this premise. The stories we read in this book just didn't add up. Or that the things we read in this book just couldn't be reconciled with the worldview we presently have or the circumstances we're walking through in our lives. Maybe we began to walk away because of what somebody else told us about this book or what somebody else told us about the stories that we didn't learn in church growing up. And that was just too much for us to handle. And the reality is that for so many of us, we know a few stories in this book, but the vast majority of us don't really know the story of this book. And the problem with that we didn't even know was a problem up until this point, the rub in our lives is simply this. It's a truth that we've come back to set the table every week of this series. Is that so often, if we don't know the story of the Bible, it becomes easy to discount the stories in the Bible. Have you found yourself there before? That as you move through circumstances, or you hear somebody else talk, or you sat through your college philosophy class, that because you didn't know the story of this book, how it came to be, what it's really about, the historical context that's meaningful and powerful, it became really easy to shift in your thinking to be able to discount the truth and the power and the relevance of the stories in this book. You see, what we know about every story of our life, it doesn't matter if it's a book, it doesn't matter if it's the story of a friend's life, the backstory always sheds light on the story. Am I right? That you can't fully know the entirety of the story until you know the backstory. You can't fully understand a person you're in relationship with until you understand what they've come from and what they've walked through in their life. And it's the reason why we believe that the story of this book is almost as important as what's written in this book. That for us to really rely on the relevance and the truth and to be able to believe in what this book says, we first have to understand how this book came to be and why we can believe that it's true. And so throughout this series, we have started this journey. This journey towards understanding and acknowledging that we are faced with a question. Which side of the story is true? Am I right? Is it the side of the story in which the church wants me to believe that this book is relevant and useful in my life right here, right now? Or is it the other side of the story from the people who have told me what else that book says and what else hasn't been talked about and that this book can't really be relied on as truthful? Which side of the story is true? And for us, we wanted to go the full way there and begin to present you with the other side of the story. And so a few weeks ago, we kicked off this series in week one by acknowledging this truth that many of us don't know. The story of the Bible doesn't actually begin within the beginning. That the story of the Bible actually begins with this guy named Jesus. Now, Jesus didn't write the Bible, but we have the Bible because of Jesus. That there was this moment in history in which this guy named Jesus didn't do what dead men do. He didn't stay dead. And when men saw him alive again after they had witnessed him die on a cross and be stabbed in the side to make sure that he was dead and brought down and buried in a tomb, and then 3 days later they saw him alive again, they knew they had to write this story down for the entirety of the world to hear it. And you see, what's so incredible is this, and maybe you've never heard this in church before. We don't believe that Jesus rose from the dead because the Bible tells us so. No, it's so much better than that. We believe that Jesus rose from the dead because men saw it, and they believed it, and they wrote about it, and oftentimes they gave their lives for it. And then in week two, we rewound into the very first story that we find in the Bible, to the creation account. And we began to acknowledge this often overlooked truth, that many of us in our reading of the account in Genesis of creation that starts with those three words we all know, in the beginning, began to believe somewhere along the way that the church or God was trying to sell us that when Moses wrote that creation account, his primary purpose was to tell us how God created the world. And what we've missed along the way that creates an unnecessary hurdle in our belief of this book is that Moses' primary purpose was never to explain to us how God created the world. Moses' primary purpose was always this, to tell us who created the world and who he created it for. That the creation account was always a story centered on me and centered on you and a God who created this world and created us as the pinnacle of creation, as image bearers. And that dictates how we act and how we impact the world around us. And then in week three, we continued with this acknowledgement that for many of us, our problems with that book don't begin and end with the creation story. That our problems go much deeper than that. And in reality, our problems are circulated all throughout the Old Testament. Am I right? That when we pick up this book and we've tried to read the Old Testament or we've heard stories told to us that weren't David and Goliath, that we're like, I'm not so sure I can reconcile these stories or believe in these stories. And we begin to take issue with the rough edges that we see on God's behavior throughout the Old Testament. And what we miss is this, is that the Old Testament is ultimately a story of God wading into the fray, into the messes of this world. It's the story of a God who was willing to play by the rules of the kingdoms of this world. Why? So that he could usher in a kingdom not of this world at just the right time. That when things got messiest and most broken, it was the story of a God who was willing to join us in our messes. And when we attempt to sand off God's rough edges of the Old Testament, we miss the mess he waded into. We miss the part of the story that's most important, that God was willing to wade into the mess thousands of years ago to prove a point to who? to you and to me that the Old Testament was always written as a divine means to a divine end. The Old Testament was always a divine means to a divine end, and the end was always you. The end was always me. Getting a gift in the form of the God of the universe sending his only son to be hung on a cross so that we would never bear the same fate. That's what the Old Testament points to. And we don't have to sand off the rough edges in order for it to be appropriate, in order for it to be meaningful and relevant and true. And that's where we pick up the story today. But every week, if you haven't been here up until this point, every week I try to start by setting correct expectations for us all. Because what I acknowledge is that if you don't have the correct expectations of what you're about to walk into, you walk out of here with much less than you were designed to get. And so what I've acknowledged every week of this series, and some of you, you've been here for all of this series, and it's going to feel mundane to you, but I don't want to miss it for those of you who are here for the very first time, is that this series is unlike any other that we do around here. Most of the other series focus heavily on the practical application within God's word for our life, how we apply it to the things we're walking through every single day. But this series is much different. This series at times will feel academic. This series is filled with historical context and facts that for some of us in this room will begin to allow our eyelids to slowly go shut. But what we believe with all of our heart is this, is that unless we can believe that this book is true, the practical application in this book is useless. Am I right? That unless this book is true, the practical application isn't true in it. And so this series is imperative. And this series is a series that even if you're not academic or factual based or don't love the historical context, that this series is so important that right now you should give the person next to you permission to nudge you if they see your head beginning to droop. Because this is something that you just cannot miss for your life and for your eternity. But today we fast forward. As we put a bow on this series, we transport to the very end of the story, and we pick up the story that we find in what's now called the New Testament of a guy named Paul. But Paul, as much as we know about him, wasn't his original name. In fact, Paul, in much of his early life, went by Saul, or Saul of Tarsus. And this isn't going to be the thrust of our message, but this is absolutely so profound and so incredible that I couldn't help but to go off on a one-minute tangent on just this point in the backstory of Paul alone. You see, Saul of Tarsus was this Jewish Pharisee. And what we know about Saul is that the moment he gave his life to Jesus, he changed his name to Paul. And we think, man, he just picked some name out of random and it kind of sounds like Saul, so he just changed a letter and he went to Paul. But what we miss in this story, this is so, so good. What we miss is that Paul at birth was actually given two names. Saul was his Jewish given name, that in his Jewish religion, he was given the name Saul. But as a Roman citizen as well, he was given a Greek or Roman name, and his Greek or Roman name was Paul. And in this moment where he gave his life to Christ, he was making this profound statement that in this moment, this message about Jesus isn't just a message for the Jewish world. And so my name can no longer just be Jewish. My name must be transported into the Greek and Roman world so that there's no obstacle between what they're hearing and my name. I have to change my name so that I relate to the entire Roman world. And so he changed his name to his Roman or Greek given name to make this statement. This message is a message for the world. Isn't that absolutely incredible? Something that for so long in my life, I didn't even know was there. It was tucked in the backstory. But this was Paul's statement in this moment. And what we know about Paul is this. Paul's one of the most famous missionaries of all time. Paul really got his name from traveling around the Roman Empire and the Mesopotamian basin and planting churches all over the Roman Empire. And then what we really hang on to Paul right now in 2021 is this facet, that as he planted those churches, he then got in a habit as he was traveling elsewhere or for most of the ending of his life was in prison, he got into the habit of writing letters to all of these different churches that he planted throughout the Roman Empire. And because of what Paul did, there was this incredible reality that as we look at Paul right now, any historian, any scholar, regardless of religious affiliation or if they're agnostic or atheist, would attest to this fact. That because of what Paul wrote, he essentially shaped a large portion of Western civilization. Paul was a big deal. And those of you who grew up in church and read so much of what Paul wrote in the New Testament in these letters he wrote to the churches, when we look at Paul, don't we kind of look at Paul as if he's like this titan of the faith? Like Paul is the colossal apostle. There is no one who compares to Paul. While the rest of the disciples were like, we're comfortable in Jerusalem, we're just going to kind of hang out here and talk to the Jews and go to the Jews' houses that we're comfortable with. No. Paul was like, I'm stepping outside of my comfort zone. I'm venturing into all the world, and I'm going to take this message as far as I can possibly take it. And that's how we view Paul. But here's what's incredible. If Paul was here today, he'd be like, guys, I have no idea why you view me like that. Like, that's not the correct view of who I am, because every morning when I get up and I look in the mirror, I see something vastly different. I don't see the colossal apostle. I don't see the titan of faith. I see a screwed up back story full of mistakes and regrets. You see, what Paul saw every morning when he woke up is something that he alludes to in this letter that he wrote to the church in Corinth. It's where we're going to spend the majority of our time this morning in this last week of this series. And this morning, if you haven't done so already, it's a perfect opportunity for you to grab your weekly. It's what you got when you came in. And if you crack that open, you'll find a notes page on the inside that'll help you follow along with us as we move through the text. You can even grab a pen if you choose to from the seat back in front of you and fill in some blanks of some things that you can hang on to in your doubts and in your questions about this book in the weeks and the months to come. But this is what Paul saw. This is how he viewed himself every single day. Starting in chapter 15, verse 9, he writes this. For I am the least of all the apostles. In fact, I'm not even worthy to be called an apostle after the way I persecuted God's church. Now, in order for us to fully understand Paul and what he brings to the table, we have to fully understand Paul's backstory. Paul didn't step onto the pages of history as a follower of Christ. In fact, the exact opposite is true. Paul stepped onto the pages of history as a Jewish Pharisee who was set out on eradicating this Nazarene sect, of getting rid of this new way of religion, following this new Jewish rabbi that was in contrast to everything the Jewish faith believed. At any possible means necessary, we've got to wipe them out. We've got to get them out of here. So much so that Paul went seeking letters from the Roman government and the Roman Empire giving him permission to murder any follower of Jesus if they would not recant their faith and turn back to something different. That was Paul's original backstory. That's who he was. And Paul, for so much of his later life, after he accepted Christ into his life and became a follower of Jesus, he carried the weight of that shame and that guilt with him every single day. It's why he wrote things like this. It's why he wrote things like you'll read in Paul's letters, I am public sinner number one. I am the worst of these. That's what Paul saw in himself. And every word that we read that Paul wrote to the churches around the empire was written from a place of absolute brokenness. Was written from a place where Paul understood the amount of grace that was afforded to him that he did not deserve because of his backstory. He made mistakes, and his letters were a plea to men and women just like you and I who have checkered past and who have made mistakes and whose pasts are full of sin and regret. Please to you and I that I know you can't fix this. You've tried. But I know a guy who can. I know a guy who can offer grace over your worst. And Paul's letter and every word bear this story. Regardless of what you've done, regardless of where you've been, Regardless of how you've treated people up until this point, there is a place in the kingdom for you. Because when I look at you, if I heard your backstory, Paul would say this: I don't care what you've done, your backstory probably pales in comparison to mine. And there was room in the kingdom for me. I was a murderer. I was a sinner at its worst, and yet God chose me to be included in his instruction manual for lives for centuries to come. And allows me to write this letter to help you see there's room in the kingdom for you as well. But in spite of the way in which Paul saw himself and the brokenness he saw staring back at him every single day, here's what's so cool about Paul. And here's where the backstory really relates to where we're going today with these last 15, 20 minutes. What we know about Paul is that Paul does an absolutely incredible job at shedding light on the story of this book. That for us to fully engage on what's written in this book, we have to engage with Paul so that we can understand the story of this book. And Paul really does this in three distinct ways. Three distinct ways that crystallize the reasons for this book and how this book is supposed to function and how we're supposed to view this book and how we're supposed to use this book. And today, as we finish our time together, I want to outline those three things and give you some incredible truth and realizations that are going to propel us forward as we move out of this series. See, the first reason that Paul really gives an incredible picture of that book is simply the easiest one of all. I thought I'd start with the easiest one, is because he wrote some of it. Paul actually wrote a good portion of what we now know as the New Testament. And Paul wrote this not as thinking this is someday going to be bound together and become the Bible. No, Paul didn't know that. You know what Paul was doing? Paul was simply writing letters to believers like you and I who are just figuring out how to make it in this world, who are just figuring out how to make the right decisions every single day and succeed in their marriages and in their parenting. Paul was writing letters to friends. That's all he was doing. And yet he wrote some of this book that gives us some incredible insight into the reason in which Paul sort of sheds light on the backstory of this book, reason number two. It's because what we know about Paul when we read what he wrote in these letters is that Paul actually does an absolutely phenomenal job at explaining the relationship between the different parts of this book. Now see if you can relate to this. If you're anything like me, you have either picked up this book before and you've read pieces and parts of it, or you've heard someone tell you about pieces and parts of it. And as you've done that, there seems to be this giant difference, am I right, between the Old Testament and the New Testament. This giant difference that begins to raise a whole lot of red flags, am I right? Like, all of a sudden, we turn from one page to another, and it's like God completely changed characters. And things are totally different. And what in the world is going on there? And if there's two different gods, then how can I really believe in this one book? You ever found yourself there before? And what Paul does is so absolutely magnificent for our faith and the believability of this book. Paul gives us insight in his writings of how the Old Testament is to be viewed now in light of the coming of Christ. Paul gives incredible insight on how the Old Testament should be viewed and used in our life now that God has come to earth and rewritten the story. And you're saying, well, how was Paul able to do that? Well, Paul was able to do that because what we talked about in Paul's backstory is that Paul was a Jewish Pharisee. What does that mean? Paul was trained and schooled for the first part of his life predominantly in understanding the Jewish law. That's what he gave his life to. That's why he hated Christians, because he gave his life to understanding and interpreting those 613 laws that we talked about last week that Moses came down off of Mount Sinai with. Paul gave his life to understanding those things and to knowing the ins and outs of those things. And because Paul was an expert in that field, it also made him expertly equipped to be able to share with you and I how those two things relate to one another. Now, with Jesus in the picture, what does this mean for the Old Testament? What does this mean for all the rough edges that we see in the Old Testament? How do we now view and use the Old Testament in light of this? And because Paul was such an expert in the relationship between these two parts of the Bible, I believe with all of my heart that if Paul was there on the day that you were handed your first Bible, Paul would have said, whoa, 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 whoa. Hey, before you crack that open, there's a couple pieces of advice that I want to give you. There's a couple pieces of advice that are imperative to the way in which you look at this book and understand this book that will shape the way in which you read it, that will shape the way in which you use it from this day forward. And those two pieces of advice were simply this. It starts here. That now that Jesus has come, what you must understand when you pick up this book is that when you read the Old Testament, you should read the Old Testament for inspiration and motivation, not for primary application. You now read the Old Testament for inspiration and motivation, but not necessarily primary application. And what we see, the reason that I make this statement, and y'all are ready to hang me up for blasphemy for saying such a thing about the Old Testament, the reason in which I make this statement is because we see Paul drive this point home time and time again in his letters. In this book we were talking about, to the church in Corinth, chapter 10, Paul writes things like this. And I don't know if you've ever noticed this before. You ever cracked open your English Bible and you start to read a little bit of it, and every section of the English Bible has a title where they've tried to tell you, like, here's what's coming. In this particular section, in this letter from Paul, the title in most English Bibles is like, Lessons from Israel's Mistakes. Lessons from Israel's Idolatry. That's what this section is all about. And Paul writes things like this. Check this out. In verse 6, he writes, These things that happened to the ancient Israelites, these mistakes that they made, are a warning to us, so that we would not crave evil things as they did, so that we would not make the same mistakes that they made. And then in verse 11, he circles back and he writes about the exact same thing. These things happened to all of them as examples for us. They were written down to warn us who live at the end of the age. The entire Old Testament is structured around a covenant between God and an ancient people. And I believe with all of my heart that Paul would want this to be known by you and by me as we look at this book. That this is a story of a contract between God and people that aren't you. The Old Testament is the story of a contract between God and people that are not you. When Jesus came, that contract was eradicated. There was a new contract that was put into place, a new contract that was so much better, full of promises for you and for me that were so much better. And hear me loud and clear. It's not that there aren't application pieces in the Old Testament, all right? Before you string me up for blasphemy of the Old Testament, it's not that there are not application pieces in the Old Testament. It's that now the Old Testament isn't meant to be the primary lens in which you sift through your application for. Jesus came and created a new primary lens that you use first to determine what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to live on this earth. The Old Testament was meant for inspiration, story after story for us to look at as an example that if you put things in place of God, things will go poorly. That if you elevate people to the place in which God is only supposed to hold, things will go poorly. The Old Testament was meant to be motivation. That as you read story after story about our God, it's proof that in our messes, God is there and he's fighting for us and he wants the best for us and he's constantly trying to come through for us. It was meant as motivation and inspiration, but it was no longer a contract that was suitable to be our primary lens for application. And because of that, Paul made this statement that your application cues now come from someplace different. Now that Jesus stepped on the scene, The second piece of advice that Paul would give is, as you pick up this book, what you need to know is, now you take your application cues from Jesus' new covenant command. With Jesus in the picture, you're now meant, as you live on this earth and you walk through your marriage, you walk through your parenting, you walk through your finances, you walk through relationships with your coworkers, that you're supposed to take your application cues from Jesus' new covenant command. And I often ask the question, like last week, remember we talked about Moses came down, 613 laws, like, isn't that enough? Jesus, why'd you have to throw a new one into the mix? Like, did we really need a 614th? And the reason that Jesus gave us this new command is not because it was in addition to the other 613. No, this one command overshadowed all 613 of the rest of them. This one new command was better and bigger than all of the rest of them. And what is that? When we get insight into that, when Jesus speaks this into fruition in John chapter 13, Jesus says this: "So now I'm giving you a new commandment. Love each other. Just as I have loved you, you should love each other. And your love for one another will prove to the world that you are my disciples." Not the way in which you carry out the 613 laws. Not the way in which you are a good Jew. No, none of that. The way in which people will know you are my follower is whether or not you are capable of loving them well. It's like Jesus was saying, it's no longer about how they deserve to be loved. The Old Testament told you your application cues should look like this: an eye for an eye. It's not like that anymore. It's no longer even about how you want to be treated. That was the golden rule. I'm giving you the platinum rule. I'm laying down this new command, this new standard of how you love other people and how you love this world around you. And in John 13, all the disciples and followers that heard Jesus say this was like, well, what is that new standard? How do we love people like you loved people? We don't quite get it. And Jesus was like, well, hold my wine that was just water. See what I did there? You guys will get that tomorrow. You'll laugh. And what he did in the next moment was he set an example for what love should look like that took their breath away. Because it literally took his breath away. He gave up his life, laid down his life for the people around him. That he set an example of what it was like to give up every part of himself for the betterment of somebody else. It's the reason why we consistently say around here that we want to grow to be a church and a group of people who are willing to give up our own preferences for the sake of someone else's eternity. Why do we say that? Because we want to follow an example of a guy who did just that. He gave up his own preferences down to the last breath of his life for the sake of everybody else's eternity. And Paul steps onto the pages of history, and Paul, in all of his writings, doesn't lay down new commandments. No, Paul gives practical application of how we live out this one commandment. Don't believe me? I wanted to give you some examples. You see, this is what Paul writes in his letter to the church in Philippi. In chapter 2, verse 5, he says, "In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus." What was Christ's mindset? From the very beginning, he understood he was going to give it all up for you. From the very beginning of your relationship with another human being, you're supposed to have the mindset that you're willing to give it up for their betterment. In Ephesians chapter 5, Paul writes, "Submit." Ugh. No. He didn't start with that word. Submit. Give up everything you want for what somebody else needs. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. And then just a few verses before that, in chapter 4, verse 32, Paul writes this: "Instead, be kind to each other. Tender-hearted, forgiving one another, just as God, through Christ, has forgiven you. And you're saying, Ben, I don't really know what it looks like in my life if I'm actually doing this and carrying this out. Can I do a one-minute practical side note for y'all? You see, in our lives, if we want to assess whether or not we are growing into people who are following Christ's standard and love for the rest of the world, there is one litmus test for us. For those of you in this room who are married or who want to be married someday or who want to be married again someday, listen up just for a second. The primary litmus test in our life for whether or not we are people who are growing towards submitting to the world around us and giving up our own preferences for the sake of somebody else's betterment lies in our marriage. Because what I believe with all of my heart is this, is that if we can't submit to our spouses, we will struggle mightily to submit to a hurting and broken world. A hurting and broken world that stabs us in the back, a hurting and broken world that doesn't always choose what we'd like them to choose. That if we can't submit to our spouses first, then we are going to struggle to submit to a world that needs us to live out Christ towards them. Y'all okay? That is our primary litmus test. And if we want to grow into people who are capable of submitting to the world as Christ did and loving the world as Christ did, then we have to start with loving our spouse the way Christ did. Hello. That's where it begins. That's where we start, and we grow out from there. But back to the main story. Our application cues now don't come from the Old Testament first. They come from Jesus first. But there's a third reason why what Paul does is so important to our understanding of this book. And this is the bow on the series. This is the reason why you came. This is what brings the entire series together. And if you walked away from your faith because of something that this book says or something that somebody told you that this book says, this is the 5 minutes that you should lean back in, because this could absolutely rock your world, rock your faith, and rock the way in which you view this book for the rest of your life. You see, the very reason that Paul does such an incredible job at shedding light on the believability of this book and the story of this book is because primarily he authenticates the most important event in it. Paul authenticates the most important event in this book. He authenticates the resurrection. And what we said in weeks before, if there is no resurrection, there is no Bible. If there is no resurrection, there is no such thing as Christianity. And you're saying, Ben, hang on. You're going to tell me just because Paul writes about it that now it authenticates it. And that's not quite good enough for me. No. I'm going to tell you better than that. I'm going to give you some historical context and some facts that are going to point to the truth. See, for some of us, we walked away from this book and even from believing the resurrection based upon things that we heard in our college philosophy class, or we heard historians write an article on this, contradicting that maybe we can't believe in the authorship of the Gospels. That maybe we can't fully believe in the authorship of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And on top of that, we can't fully believe in the timetable in which the church wants us to believe that these books were written. You see, what historians and naysayers want us to believe is this. They want us to believe that you really can't know that Matthew wrote Matthew. And we don't really have any factual proof of who Mark even is. We don't know who Mark is. And Luke, yeah, Luke wrote Luke, but he didn't write Luke at the time in which you thought he wrote it. He wrote it a long time after that. And you all heard about John, but we don't actually even have any factual proof that John wrote John. And so all these things can't be believed, and because of that, you can't believe the timetable in which these were written. that these things were actually written and contrived by the church as a global organization. And the resurrection was a myth that grew throughout time. And eventually the church put a stake in it and contrived the scriptures centuries after what they're portrayed to have been written. That's what the world wants you to believe. It wants you to believe that this isn't truth, that this isn't factual, that there's no historical context to support this. But there's one major argument that stands in contrast to their argument. His name is Paul. And it comes in the form of his letter to the church in Corinth. See, what I believe with all of my heart, and I want to set the table for this, I believe with all of my heart that Paul's letter to the Corinthian believers is indisputable evidence that the resurrection was accepted as fact immediately, not eventually. The resurrection was accepted as fact immediately, not eventually. And to make this case, the most fitting way I could think to do this and for you guys to picture this is to show you a timeline of what takes place. You see, the timeline goes like this, and what's so incredible about this timeline is this, is that the same historians that want you to believe that the authorship and the timetable of the Gospels cannot be believed are the same dudes who are incapable of disputing, who would attest to the fact that we know Paul is a real guy. Paul actually wrote the first letter to the church in Corinth. There's no disputing that. And Paul wrote this first letter to the church in Corinth at about 55 AD. The same guys who want you to believe that the Gospels aren't believable cannot negate the fact Paul's real. Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, and he wrote it around 55 AD. Now, to dig into the timeline for just a few seconds, Paul writes this letter to Corinth in 55, about 3 years after Paul visited the city of Corinth and planted this church in the city. 3 years later, he writes a letter to that church that he planted in Corinth. And he planted this church about 3 years and 12 years after his two distinct historical fact trips to Jerusalem. Paul visited Jerusalem for one primary purpose, to visit the disciples and the apostles who witnessed Jesus coming back from the dead. He spent his entire trips with the apostles and the disciples who spent 3 years with Jesus, saw him die on a cross, and saw him come back to life again. And he spent time because he wanted to hear the stories, because he wanted to make sure that they were accurate and that they were factually true. And Paul decided to take these visits about starting 3 years after his conversion to Christianity. In fact, historians can't even contradict that. A famous agnostic or even atheist historian would even attest to the fact that Paul probably converted sometime around 35 AD, just 2 short years after Jesus' resurrection that happened in 33 AD. And some of y'all, just from looking at this, you already know where I'm going. You already see the importance of this timeline. How could Paul possibly have known about something that happened that was a myth and that was contrived centuries after it supposedly happened? How could Paul have known about this, spoken about this, written about this so close to the resurrection when the resurrection wasn't even true? It was written by the global church centuries after the fact to make a stake in the ground of a myth that grew over time. The answer is this. You can't have it both ways. On one side of the page, they want you to believe that you can't believe in the Gospels because they were written long after the fact. But what they negate to include is on the other side of the page, they also can't stand in contradiction that Paul was real and he wrote about the resurrection and he spoke to guys that saw the resurrection within 2 decades of it actually happening. Paul is the greatest factual proof to the event that launched Christianity and that Christianity still stands on today. Paul literally wrote about it in this letter to the church in Corinth that we find in chapter 15, starting in verse 1. Now, brothers and sisters, I want to remind you of the gospel I preached to you, which you received and on which you have taken your stand. Remember when I visited you 3 years ago? I talked to you about this resurrection, about what actually happened in our world. For what I received, what I was told, I passed on to you as of first importance. What did we talk about? That Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures. That he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, who was Peter. And they'd have been like, whoa, 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 whoa. How do you know, Paul, that he appeared to Peter? Well, because in 40 and 49 AD, I went and visited them, and I talked to them, and they told me the stories of what they saw and what they believed and what they wrote about. And then he appeared to the 12. Well, Paul, how do you know he appeared to the... I just told you. I visited them. I heard their stories. I saw what they saw. And after that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living. You know what Paul's saying in this one sentence? It's like his drop the mic moment. Fact check me. I dare you. Grab a bus ticket. Go to Jerusalem and talk to all of these people who are still alive, who actually saw it happen. And then the next statement that Paul makes is just absolutely profound. Most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. And Paul shifts the terminology around death in this moment. You know what sleeping people do? What do sleeping people do? They wake up. Paul shifts this terminology because you know what was happening at this time? First century believers lost their fear of death. Why? Because they were following a man who came back from death. And you've heard me say this before. If somebody predicts their own death and predicts they will raise again and beat death and they actually do it, you just listen to what they have to say. You just go with it. Am I right? And here they listen to this man predict his own death and then beat it and come back to life. This man who promised them this term he referred to again and again and again called eternal life. And their fear of death evaporated because what they believed is that we are but mere sleepers. And that because of this guy named Jesus, we will come back to life again. There is nothing to fear. There's nothing to be scared of. And he continues. Then he appeared to James. And this might be the biggest deal of all, y'all. Because you know who James is? James was Jesus' brother. And for those of y'all who have siblings, do you know what it's like or what it would be like to try to convince your brother that you are the Son of God? Ain't happening, am I right? That's James' story. For all of Jesus' life, you know what James believed? My brother is off his rocker. He is a crazy dude who's spewing things that I know ain't true. I live with him. He leaves his underwear out of the hamper just like the rest of y'all. There ain't no way he's the Son of God. And you know when things changed for James? When he watched his brother hang up on the cross and have a spear driven into his side. He watched his brother breathe his last. And James felt oddly vindicated in that moment. I told you. Told you. But the story changed for James when 3 days later, his brother wasn't dead anymore. His brother had come back to life. And much like the rest, James began to understand that this man is who he says he was. And James, much like the rest, began to write about who Jesus actually was and the difference that he could make in their lives. And he finishes, and then Jesus appeared to all of the apostles. At the very same time that Paul was writing this to the church in Corinth, you know what else was happening? Guys like James were writing their story of this man named Jesus and the way in which he changed lives. Guys like Peter, who historians want you to believe, there's no way that 1 Peter and 2 Peter can be really written by Peter, because what we know about Peter in Acts is that he was illiterate. Yeah, what we also know from biblical evidence is that Peter didn't write them. You're right. Peter dictated them to somebody else who wrote them and was literate. It's not that difficult. We get that all laid out for us. You can only ignore the other side of the story for so long. And they wrote these documents that became valuable. Why? Not because everybody knew that these guys were somehow chosen to write what would one day become the New Testament. Nobody knew that. That was unfathomable at the time. No, these were valuable and precious because they knew who these guys were. And they knew what they had seen. They were valuable, and they were hung on to, because what people began to see is that the words these guys were writing down were impacting lives and eternities, not just in Jerusalem, but across the entire Roman world. That there was proof in the life of man after man, woman after woman, child after child, that this guy named Jesus could change lives living right in front of their faces. And then hundreds of years later, something incredible happened. In the 4th century AD, an emperor by the name of Constantine barged onto the scene of power and chose to eradicate the laws against Christianity. And in an instant, the empire who had dictated the crucifixion of Christ now orchestrated the collection of documents that pointed to him. And by the late 4th century, the Hebrew Old Testament was combined with the documents that had become the New Testament to make the Biblia, the Bible. The Bible that didn't just have the power to change lives in the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th century. No, the Bible that changed my life and has the power to change yours as well. That is real and living and active and relevant and can be a stake that we stand on in our faith right here, right now, today. But to wrap this up, if there's one thing I want you to take from this series, it's this. It's that this book, the Bible, didn't create Christianity. That's not how this thing works. Christianity is the result of an event, the resurrection, that created a movement, the local church, that produced text, documentation written that cannot be disputed by real life men and women who saw it, lived it, believed it, and gave their life for it, that were collected, protected, lives given for what would eventually become a book to Biblia, the Bible. And the story of this book matters because it's a story that's for you, and it's a story that's for me. A story that centers on one imperative question. And for too long, you and I have thought that question is this: are you at peace with everything that's written in this book? The story of this book does not point to that one imperative question. The story of this book points to a much different one. Are you at peace with a God who sent his only Son to die on a cross so that you and I could spend eternity with our Creator? That is the question that is most important. That is the question that this book was meant to help you answer. Nothing else, nothing different. It begins and it ends there. And so the question that we end with is this: now that you know the other side of the story, are you willing to face that question? Are you willing to make that question the focal point of your life? Would you pray with me? Father, this morning, God, we thank you for what a great God you are. We thank you for the instruction manual you give us. An instruction manual that is based upon fact and proof and historical context. An instruction manual that's real and relevant and allows us to use the practical application in it because we can believe the truth of it. So God, this morning, with all the facts, with all the proof stacked up, may we stand firm on the reality that this book is real, that this book is meaningful, and that this book is meant for my life. We thank you for that. It's in your name I pray. Amen. See, this morning, I want to end with two distinct things. The first is this. If you're here for the very first time, and you endured today, and the facts, and the proof, and the deepness of it, we wanted to do something just to say thanks for enduring that. We would love for you on your way out. We promise no strings attached to stop at our connections booth in the corner of our lobby. And we've got a first-time visitor pack that we'd just like to give to you to say thanks for being here. On top of that, next week we're shifting to a new series. It's a series that we're calling Warrior. And over the course of the next 4 weeks, we're going to be digging in to the difficulty of the world and the life we live and how we fight back in that. The tools that we have available to us that allow us to be warriors, to face our fears, to plunge forward into risk of our life and to live better marriages, to be better parents, to manage our finances better, and to become the warriors that we were created to be. It's going to be a series that we believe with all of our hearts you do not want to miss, and especially the men in your life do not want to miss this series. It's going to be a series that connects directly to their hearts, but ladies, you won't be left out. This series will be one that you will get plenty out of as well. And so again, we hope that you have a great rest of your Memorial Day weekend. Have a great rest of your Sunday. We hope to see you next week. We'll see you soon.